You're listening to Arrivé by The Cycling Podcast. This episode is made possible by Bicycle, the leading global marketplace for pre-owned bikes.
Brian,
yeah.
1 kilometer to go. Matheus Sobreiro, he's a friend of the podcast actually. Didn't expect him to be at the pointy end of San Remo at this point. What, 900 meters?
Yeah, Pidcock hot on his tail. But it's just a quick, it's a very, very small gap. Now it's almost just the positioning going into the last roundabout.
Your countryman, Mats Pedersen, has got to be the favorite now, hasn't he?
Yeah, you think he's got Sturven there to pull the sprint. But they still have a small gap. They'll have to open this quite early. Any hesitation down the group behind means that the two up in front.
Pogacar got his chance. He looked like the rider with the most zip in his legs on the Poggio.
Certainly did. Well, here comes Pidcock. Here comes Pidcock with a gap. Sobreiro can't follow.
Van der Poel looks like he's done as well. He's done so much pulling. Pidcock, what's he got? 100 meters? Yeah. 50 meters?
Yeah, now Sturven opens up for Pedersen, but is it too late? Is it too late?
I think there's going to be revelry in the streets of Copenhagen tonight, Brian. Matthews.
Matthews.
Is that Philipsen's there?
Yeah. No. But Peter's not going to get it. He's out of gas.
It's Philipsen. That's Philipsen's agent, Alex Carrera. Philipsen, Matthews, Pogacar.
Wow. 46.1 average.
1-3 for Alex Carrera. Good day for him.
He just ran out of here like a dog was chasing him.
He dropped us all. Brian Philipsen, I didn't even know he was in that group.
Buonasera, Brian.
Buonasera, Daniel.
Third attempt at recording this podcast.
Arrivé.
Arrivé might finally arrive at some point this evening after we've overcome all of our issues.
That's the editorial we, or are you just referring to yourself?
Yeah. If we ever overcome all of our technical issues. We had some technical issues last night. We produced a sort of bootleg rogue podcast, a new sort of format we put out on Substack, and had some problems with that. Brian, we also had some problems trying to commentate. I felt that I had some problems trying to commentate on the finish of San Remo when we stood on Villaron. We heard that in the intro. Why was it so difficult? Because this race happens at warp speed. The finale happens at warp speed, and it's very difficult to sort of decipher what's going on. I have sort of laser focused vision on a couple of riders, and I wasn't even aware that Jasper Philipsen was in that group or as close to the sort of business end of proceedings as he turned out to be, and he was the winner of this edition of Milan San Remo, as we are about to discuss. But Brian, currently we're on the Via Matteotti, which is a sort of parallel street to the Via Roma. On the Via Matteotti is San Remo's most famous landmark, I would suggest. It's the
Ariston.
The Ariston Theatre/Cinema, where we used to have the press conferences.
San Remo's version of LA is the Chinese theatre, where they have the Oscar award show.
Yes, yes. And so this is a sort of hallowed location for San Remo. Brian, I wonder if anyone's caught Alex Carrera yet. Not only Tadej Pogacar's agent, but Jasper Philipsen's agent, who was a very happy man, as
he's
we heard.
He's lighting the biggest cigar with nothing but 500 euro notes.
Yes, an extremely good day for him. Philipsen's a new signing for those guys as well, yep. The Carreras. And what I don't think it was much of a gamble signing up Jasper Philipsen, but they probably felt as though they had spent the afternoon in the casino and had a big win, Brian.
Yeah, their number came out pretty clear.
Yeah.
I mean, they would have been, I think, equally as happy to see Pogacar win, because they're obviously very close to him. But they couldn't really ask for more, to be fair. 1 and 2. Even they're from different teams, but they managed both
of them.
They'll
be cashing their chips, the Carrera brothers. Brian, last night we had dinner, we had a drink, and we were talking about the casino. If you're here in Italy, don't call it the casino, because that means something else entirely. Brian, talking to people who spent a lot of time and money in there, the famous director, film director Vittorio De Sica, director of Bicycle Thieves, probably the most famous film ever about bicycles. He spent a lot of time there
and money.
Spent a lot of money, so much so that at one point he suggested they should, when he died, install some kind of plaque on the front door, over the front door of the casino, to thank him for his contribution to building and maintaining the casino, because by that point he estimated...
I sense no bitterness.
No, by that point he thought he probably would have spent a small fortune, and he did. Another story I told you last night, Brian, a king of Egypt.
That's my favorite one.
The king of Egypt, Farouk of Egypt. He was an habitué of the casino in San Remo, and he had one very big win in a game of poker when he had a hand of three kings and something else, and he threw it down and he said, I'm the fourth king, and he scooped all the chips and off he went merrily to cash them.
Good to be the king.
And Jasper Philipsen was the king today. Brian, let's tell people what happened in this edition of Milan San Remo, shall we? It was a pretty sort of conventional one in the sense that a break went away almost, well, when the flag went down. I think
apart from the unconventional element that it started in Pavia and not in Milano.
True. Yeah, it was a Pavia San Remo. 10 riders went away. Brian, I'm going to read their names. Davide Baldaccini, Valerio Conti, Kirlio Tsarenko, Sergio Samitier, Romain Combeau, Davide Baez, Mirko Maestri, Andrea Pietrobon, Alessandro Tonelli, more about him in a second, and Samuele Zoccarato. So that was 10 riders, 7 Italians, 3 from Coretec, 3 from Polti Cometa, 2 from Bardiani, and 1 from Movistar. Lorenzo Germani of Groupama was also there at one point, but he dropped back. And Brian, they stayed together for an awfully long time, while in the group behind, it was Alpecin De Koninck with Sylvain Dillier and Jacopo Mosca with for Little Trek, who were doing most of the pacemaking for most of the day, because that group would stay together, or some of them would stay away until after the Cipressa. I mentioned Tonelli, Brian. Tonelli and Milan San Remo, well, what a love affair that is. The breakaway in Milan San Remo, what a love affair that is. Today he spent well over 200 kilometers away, probably over 250. In 2020, he spent 264 kilometers off the front. 2021, 269 kilometers. 2022, 279 kilometers. And 2023, 259 kilometers. The Cipressa, San Lorenzo al Mare, that right turn to the Cipressa, that was the moment we'd all been waiting for, because a lot of the pre-race talk had revolved around that and what UAE were going to do there, Brian. There'd been talk of them trying to break the 9-minute barrier. The record on the Cipressa is around 9 minutes 30. And my finger was poised, wasn't it? Over my thumb was poised over the stopwatch. I pressed go as they came onto the Cipressa. And when I stopped it at the top, it read 9 minutes.
This is the influence of Strava on us,
yeah,
dissecting and analyzing bike races. I mean, yeah, they... I'm not... This is not like live corrections corner. They were trying to destroy the peloton more than they were trying to do a sub-9 Cipressa.
Yes, true. And they did. Well, we'll talk about...
Yeah, they did, yeah.
We'll talk about this in great detail, but they certainly did. They got rid of a lot of significant riders. There were other riders. Christophe Laporte, I don't know what happened to him today, at Visma Lisa bike. He was... Well, they shedded him earlier, even earlier, I think on the Cappi. But it was a pretty small group.
Jonathan Milan as well.
Jonathan Milan, although he came back at one point, didn't he? But it was a pretty small group as they went over the Cipressa. And then it was a bit of a sort of ceasefire in the Bermuda Triangle, the no man's land between the Cipressa and the Poggio. Some riders got back on.
Then the Imperia Triangle.
The Imperia Triangle. And then, Brian, what happened on the Poggio? In the blur of action and attacks, well, not too many attacks, but it was certainly fast on the Poggio. What did we see?
Yeah, so UAE were trying to do what they set out to do on the Cipressa and failed, because they were out of horsepower, really, to do the damage that they probably could have done if they had more riders up there. But Tim Wellens did an enormous pull for Tadej Pogacar, who was basically leading the whole way up, doing two attacks, especially the last attack was almost at the top of the the Poggio, and only really only Van der Poel was able to follow, but the riders behind them were so close. And as we found out afterwards, Philipsen asked Van der Poel to slow down a little bit, but we'll come back to that.
You're right, Brian. And Pogacar crested the Poggio first. A second or two behind was Van der Poel, and a second or two behind him was a group featuring Pedersen, Bettiol,
Pidcock,
Philipsen, Mohoric, and others. And there were a couple of those riders. Pidcock tried an attack on the descent of the Poggio, quite a long way down the Poggio. Same with Mohoric. They weren't really able to get away, but things did come back together to an extent. A dozen or so riders were together.
It was a reshuffle on leading up to the Via Roma, really.
Yeah, as the peloton came down onto the Via Aurelia, which is the main road that kind of feeds onto Via Roma, Matteo Sobrero tried a counterattack. Pidcock tried his second attempt at a counterattack after the one on the Poggio.
Pretty serious, actually.
It did. It looked at one point as though that could succeed. However, it did not, Brian. And we heard in our intro, I thought Mads Pedersen, with a kilometre to go, was poised to take his first Milan-San Remo, particularly with Jasper Stuyven there to potentially lead him out. However, that's not what happened, is it, Brian? Philipsen won the sprint. Second was Michael Matthews. Third, Tadej Pogacar. Fourth, Mads Pedersen. Fifth, Alberto Bettiol. Sixth, Matej Mohoric. Seventh, Maxime Van Hills. Jasper Stuyven was eighth. Julien Alaphilippe, a resurgent Julien Alaphilippe, was ninth. Mathieu van der Poel, tenth. And Tom Pidcock, 11th. Honourable mention to Matteo Sobrero, who, as we mentioned, did try to counter on the Aurelia just before the Via Roma. And he rounded off that 12-man group that came in together. And then the next rider was Casper Pedersen, 35 seconds down. So, Brian, Jasper Philipsen's first monument. A couple of very disappointed riders with him on the podium, as much as they were both happy and magnanimous about Philipsen, but they were pretty disappointed themselves, Tadej Pogacar and Michael Matthews. Let's hear from them now, speaking to our colleagues from Eurosport. Let's go first to Pogacar and then Matthews.
I couldn't have done much better, but it was close.
Yeah, it's also to be confirmed. It looked like one of the fastest editions, maybe the fastest. And you said not really hard, so yeah. Maybe the way the peloton race, maybe too compact.
Yeah, I don't know. I think today was one of the easiest races ever. We rode really super easy tempo the first few hours, but anyway, it was. It's like I said before the race, everything needs to be perfection, and today was not everything perfect, but we did really good, and I think podium was the most we could do.
Yeah, it's hard. Obviously happy with the podium, but being so close, it's bittersweet. I think tomorrow morning I'll be happy with my performance, but this moment right now, being this close to a monument after so many podiums, yeah, it's hard.
And those two big attacks by Tadej Pogacar on the Poggio, just talk me through those.
Yeah, obviously they were difficult, but I think they probably weren't as strong as we all thought through the race. But that suited me better, and I could get through the climbs with better legs in the finish. So, yeah, I think I'm not exactly sure what happened to them, but we rode our race and we came up with the podium, so we're happy.
You're listening to Arrivé by The Cycling Podcast. This episode is made possible by Bicycle, the leading global marketplace for pre-owned bikes.
As you will have heard from the opening titles of this episode, our Arrivé series returns this spring thanks to Bicycle, which is an online marketplace where cyclists can buy and sell bikes with complete confidence. Online buying and selling can involve certain risks, especially with high-value items, but Bicycle eliminates a lot of those risks, offering security for both the buyer and the seller. I've been having a look at the website, which is bicycle.com, and also the app, which you can download onto your phone, and my first impression is that it's really like being in a digital Aladdin's cave of bikes. There's pretty much every brand that you can think of for sale on there. There's some really top-end bikes. There's an awful lot of what I would say are your second bike, the sort of bike that you're quite happy to take out in the rain, leaving your best bike for all of those glorious sunny days. Over the course of our Spring Classics coverage, I'll be telling you how Bicycle works and why you should consider it if you want to buy a pre-used bike or if you're perhaps thinking of selling one of your bikes. I know that's unlikely because really, who wants to get rid of a bike? That's pretty much how I thought until I started looking at how Bicycle works. Now, selling a bike can be quite tricky. If you want to sell it in person to somebody who may be able to come to your home and collect it, or if you want to sell it via a local bike shop, you're really restricting the pool of people that would be interested in buying it. And if you use one of the mainstream online marketplaces that sell absolutely everything, well, that can be fraught with problems too, not least because there's a lot of time wasters or people who are looking to haggle the price down to an unrealistic degree. Bicycle puts both the buyer and seller into a much stronger position. And just from looking at the way the website is designed and the care that people have put into photographing their bikes so they look really good and listing what the bike is, describing it well so that you've got a real degree of confidence that what you're buying is what's going to turn up in the box. And I immediately feel like I'm among like-minded people. This is a marketplace for cyclists selling bikes to other cyclists. And that gives that degree of confidence that I was talking about. I'll go into more detail later in the series about how Bicycle works, but they'll vet sellers to weed out any scammers. There's a secure payment system, so the money is kept securely until both parties are happy with the transaction. The buyer can opt into a service and repair plan, and Bicycle will even do carbon checks to make sure the frame hasn't been damaged or poorly repaired. And if you're selling, Bicycle will ship you a box to make the packing easy. So it really takes the stress and strain out of selling a bike online. Anyway, I'll be looking in more depth at Bicycle over the course of the Spring Classics, but in the meantime, Bicycle is available to people looking to buy or sell a bike in more than 30 countries. So if you're in North America, Europe, or the UK, check it out yourself at bicycle.com or download the app. Arrivé returns in a couple of weeks with two episodes covering the men's and women's Tour of Flanders. Now, though, it's back to Daniel and Brian in San Remo.
Well, Brian, before that short commercial interlude message about our new sponsor for Arrivé, Bicycle, we heard from Michael Matthews and Tadej Pogacar. All friends, everyone friends, as we've already said.
Lance Armstrong's not going to like it. He thinks they're probably too wishy-washy and happy-go. I mean, they clearly like each other. It's certainly a far cry from that tiny sofa behind the podium last year that seemed socially quite awkward. With Van der Poel and Van Aert and Ganna.
They are very good friends, aren't they?
This was the real friends' couch.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, the real friend. Yeah. I've just rewatched all seven series, isn't it, of Friends? So that's very much at the forefront of my mind.
Clamoroso.
But Brian, they are extremely good friends, all of them, I think. Certainly Pogacar and Philipsen and Pogacar and Matthews. Matthews and Pogacar came to San Remo together. It's a pretty short journey from their home in Monaco the other day. Well, and the only
they
member...
They came to Milano together, didn't they?
Oh, sorry. I mean, Milano, yeah, of course.
They might also like go back home to Monaco in the same car, but they still had to go up to Pavia at least.
The only member of that travelling party who was not on the podium was Tadej Pogacar's girlfriend, Urszula Zegart. But Brian, Philipsen and Van der Poel, well, that was a dynamic duo today, wasn't it? And a very harmonious duo as well.
Yeah. When the defending champion in the World Championships jersey basically, he certainly sacrificed his own chances, and he did say also, Van der Poel did, he didn't feel as good as last year. But I think that was a very generous and tactically also brilliant way of making sure his team could win the race. Philipsen said to Van der Poel on the race radio that he should slow down on a descent. And he said on the team radio as well, after the Gipressi, he hadn't felt his legs yet. So he was clearly on. He said he had never had as good legs as he had today. A pretty good day to have it when you're his type of rider, because this is the one monument that he can really win. Massive deal for them, but I think also it showed, which we also saw at the Tour de France, a side of Van der Poel where he's a winner, he's a real champion, he's obviously a world champion, and has won classics left and right, but he's certainly also a good teammate. He was today.
Yes, and that's the holy grail, isn't it? To have a teammate and to have a strong teammate over the top of the Poggio. That's what we've always said. And, you know, Van der Poel, he is this sort of superhuman who contributes in ways that others simply can't. He does things that other riders simply can't. And so many riders and so many teams over the last few years have failed in that endeavour of having a teammate there on the other side of the Poggio. And, you know, Little Trek did it to an extent with Sturven. There was a bit of a mea culpa from, or there was a big mea culpa from your countryman, Mads Pedersen, about his sprint when he spoke to the press this evening. So I don't think you can sort of throw any blame Sturven's way. I think he did a brilliant job as well. And look, Pedersen was in the position that he would have dreamed about.
I hadn't heard the interview, but he came short, didn't he? Didn't have the legs to finish the job. There's no such thing as being handled anything on a silver platter when you've done almost 300 kilometers at 46 an hour. You know, that's bike racing.
Brian, the Pogacar question, the UAE question. As I said, so much of the attention before the race was focused on them because of these comments from Machin. And this is, you know, cycling sort of specializes in these narratives. It's great when someone throws something like that out there, and he even, you know, he put a number on it. So we were all watching. As I said, I started my stopwatch at the bottom of the Cipressa. We initially, and we were watching it together, Brian, when we saw where UAE were, where Pogacar was at the foot of the Cipressa, we said, and there were other journalists around us, we all turned to each other and said, it was a bluff. That was not their intention, because they weren't the team that led onto the Cipressa, and they weren't even in the first sort of 10 positions. And then Isaac Del Toro came up the side, and Tim Wellens came up the side, and, well, we'll hear in a second from Mark Hirschi, who was with Pogacar, but it looked a little bit disorganized. And it's
Well, Philipson even said in the press conference that they were disorganized, the UAE was.
Maybe it's naive, or it would be naive to expect them to be sort of perfectly aligned and perfectly, well, as they hope to be at the foot of the Cipressa.
I don't know what the reasoning behind not bringing McNulty, who is either super tired or in the shape of his lifetime.
Yes, Brian. You know, I spoke to Steve Cummings at the finish as well, and, you know, he talked about, well, you can have all the plans or any plan you want to do the Cipressa in 9 minutes and to blow the race apart. However, the race to the Cipressa, there is a 50-kilometer race to the foot of the Cipressa, and you have to control a lot of variables within that, or just over an hour of racing. And UAE did a pretty decent job, and Pogacar was there, and he probably had the legs that he wanted to have. But it didn't work to the extent that they wanted. And, you know, I did some commentary today with Ned Bolting on the World Feed, actually. And we were talking about this, Pogacar and Sanremo. And is he ever going to win it? How is he ever going to win it? And it does feel to me as though it would be akin to bottling lightning, because so much has to go right for him. The way this race has evolved, there are always going to be fast riders there in the finale, and there are always going to be small groups. And he's almost fast enough to beat those sort of jet-set sprinters, but not quite. And I think he probably will do it once. I don't think necessarily he will do it twice. Whereas I said to Ned earlier, I can see Van der Poel winning this race 4 or 5 times.
Yeah, it's the difference today was Philipsen. No, not saying that Pogacar, I mean, he clearly didn't today, could beat Michael Matthews, but maybe he could potentially. If you look at, you know, how many years Michael Matthews has been very, very close and almost forever unsuccessful, but still, I think this is one of his favorite bike races. But I think Pogacar has the potential to win it, but like you said, it's like bottling light. Everything really has to fall into place. And it almost did today. And we've been critical about their performance with, you know, the Cipressa, you know, gate, if you could even call that. But I think the comeback they did, how they sort of came back and took control of the race, especially with Tim Wellens on Poggio, I thought that was quite impressive. They certainly didn't give up, and Pogacar did what Pogacar would have done anyways, even if the group had been more reduced after the Cipressa and had they been successful. So, and Pogacar is one of those riders who can actually do something like that more than once. Did it twice. ran short of kilometers. Poggio is only, you know, as short as it is, and his gradient is not really, you know, in his favor.
Brian, I mentioned, I think, that we would hear from Mark Hirschi about UAE and their plan and how they executed, how well they executed that. I spoke to him at the finish line, and here is Mark Hirschi talking about that 9-minute 26-second ascent of the Cipressa led by his UAE team.
Yeah, I tried to pull after the Cipressa. Normally I was planned to go to Poggio, but it was so hard, so we had nobody left. And then the final, I didn't know exactly. I just hear he was third. I mean, it's super hard to make the difference here. It's a long race, but the climbs are fast. So at the end, it's what it is.
Tell me something, the team principals, the guys from the car, were they satisfied at the end with third place?
I mean, I didn't know exactly what happened in front because the radio is not working when you're behind. But I mean, for sure we give all, and we tried. They tried, and it didn't work out. So we have to be happy.
Mark, we heard about this plan for a 9-minute Cipressa. It was 9:26. Was this a real plan? Was this something that you were definitely going to try and execute?
For sure, we know. Like, you see, the group was small. I think if you go 9:30 or smaller, already with Formula, I think we went super fast 2 years ago. It was like 30 riders, the same like this year. So yeah, we tried to go as hard as possible with Diego and Isaac. Yeah, it's not easy because you need to be in front. Everybody wants to be in front. And yeah, we tried to make it as hard as possible, but still the climb is, I think, 36K average. So it's hard to make the difference against the big guys.
And was the hope that Tadej would be on his own on the top of the Cipressa, or just to take a small group away and, you know, maybe without Philipsen and those guys in it?
Yes, we just want to go hard to hurt other guys, so they have some luck that before Poggio. Yes, because it was never the plan to go Cipressa alone because it's too far.
Tadej said it was just very easy before you got to the Capi, and maybe too easy.
Yeah, I mean, it was not super hard. At the breakaway and the start, they slow down, so they were riding smart, and then also for us was, we needed all the guys to make the race hard, so we could not pull too hard and waste one guy.
So Brian, it'll be interesting we probably won't find out exactly what the conclusions of the UAE debrief are, but come this time next year, I mean, I get the sense that Tadej Pogacar will carry on doing this race until he wins. He's pretty determined. Obviously, he's found a way to make it sort of fit into his schedule. He's going to Catalunya this weekend. It feels to me as though he will, again, continue to find a way to fit it into his schedule until he wins. But it's going to be interesting to see what they come up with next. Or do they just keep knocking on the same door in the same way until that door sort of eases open?
Yeah, but also, to be honest, they could have done an 8:50 on Cipressa. But if Van der Poel had been at the peak of his abilities, what were they going to do afterwards?
I mean, the question, I suppose, is how much can they beat people up on the Cipressa? And was Pogacar getting so close to Matthews and Philipsen and beating Pedersen and beating other fast riders? Was that the direct result of how fast they rode the Cipressa? And, you know, going 20 seconds faster, would that mean maybe he would have taken Matthews out of the equation?
Potentially. I mean, this is the microscope perspective again, isn't it? So, yeah, it's also, as always with these things, it's hindsight. But you can see from Pogacar's ambition that how important the classics are to him. You know, there's so many, like basically all other GC riders have shunned away from them or have waited until they've done winning Grand Tours. For instance, you know, Wiggins trying to have a go at Roubaix. And I think the way he honors and also makes them important, you know, a lot of maybe younger, certainly younger than I am, cycling fans who are not particularly fond of San Remo and they can't really figure out what the attraction is. Well, it's certainly very attractive to Pogacar. And I think that's, I mean, RCS must be happy and cycling history should be very, very happy that we have a champion who also wants to win these races.
Brian, what would you be inclined to do? Would you be inclined to rip up the plan again next year and come here with something different? Or I think my instinct would be to just keep plugging away and keep and be committed to what you think is the way to win San Remo, and that is with an attack on the Poggio, because let's face it, as we mentioned last night, it's a lot. Well, it's 1996 was the last win on the Cipressa. So the evidence suggests that if you're not a sprinter, that is the way to win it. He's not going to win it. He's not going to do what Matej Mohoric did a couple of years ago either. He's a good descender, but he's not that good. So what options really are available to him?
Well, it's straightforward. They just have to make the race as hard as possible. But the one thing that was a game changer today, it was also the composition of the riders chasing. And it was the decision that Van der Poel actually willingly slowed down because Philipsen was on his way back up to the front of the first group. So, I mean, there's so many things you can do, but if you want to make Milano San Remo hard, I mean, they might have to start in the Turchino next time, you know? That's what Bettiol said, I think, before the race, that could be an idea for him even. So, yeah, I mean, that's happened. I think it was Kipucci and Rolf Sørensen went there one year.
Yes, they did, yeah. Brian, just a word on your countryman, Mads Pedersen. We've mentioned how he did have Stöven there and the team rode well. He was in a dream scenario for him, but it didn't work out. How disappointed do you think he will be?
Very disappointed. I mean, he's had sort of a... not a love-hate. I mean, I think he actually used that expression about Milano Sanremo that... I mean, the first year he was, when he was sixth, he wasn't even supposed to be there, but he was, you know, substitute, I suppose. And I think he's also realized that's my theory anyways, that he has, let's say, 3 or 4 years to win a monument. And there's certainly two other monuments that he'd rather win. But if you are able to build up that shape, if you have a team that's strong enough, and when you look at how he can win bike races, long, hard... Yeah. Bike race where he can open a sprint and potentially beat, you know, even the faster in terms of top speed sprinters. San Remo is an obvious race for him. And the way it ended up today, I don't think there was a lot of people at the finish line who had major doubts that he wouldn't finish the job, because normally he would. But in this instance, and watching the replay a couple of times, he has not himself to blame, but his legs, in the sense that they were just faster. I don't think he could have wanted any better support than Stöven did. Certainly not in the second part of, like, once they were done coming down the Poggio. So,
I'm sure, of course,
he's extremely disappointed. Like,
just to sort of labour the point we made last night. I mean, you say that he can win in lots of different ways, but this has become such a hard race. Not in the sense that it's difficult to finish. But you look at the size of the group.
Top 10.
Yeah, you look at the size of the group as well. And one thing we didn't mention last night when we talked about the possible addition, or in the past, people talking about adding climbs. I think this race, more than any other, has been affected, changed, maybe completely transformed by the fact that you only have 7 men in your team now.
That makes a huge
difference.
Especially when you see, you know, we're also in the era of certain super teams. Which, ironically, well, I wouldn't say ironically, the Alpecin De Koenig has become.
Yeah.
They not only took the Koenig Quickstep sponsor, they also stole their mojo. Because whether we like it or not, and I credit full credit to them, they're one of the strongest classics teams in the world right now. We just look elsewhere sometimes. You know, we think of Van der Poel as a one-man army, or a team that's like a one-trick pony, but it's certainly not. When you have a class rider like Philipsen who could finish the job today.
Look what Dillier did today.
Incredible. Incredible.
I don't know how long he pulled for, 150 kilometers?
He's probably pushing 10,000 calories deficit after today. He can have a bigger dinner than I'm going to have.
What you're going to eat, in about 10 minutes from now.
What a pleasure to see you.
It's the same for me, obviously.
We haven't seen you for so many months. I had to grab you just as the peloton approaches the Cipressa. Ciro, this plan that Pogacar's got, the sub-9-minute Cipressa, it's like the sub-3-minute marathon, sub-3-hour marathon. Can it be done?
Actually, really, I don't know. I read a lot of calculation when Formolo did in 9 minutes and 30, remade only 27 riders. When he did in 9 minutes and 50 seconds, 70 riders. Dear listeners, these are numbers. But cycling, in my opinion, is more about numbers. Not only about numbers. It should be more about art, passion, courage.
Ciro, I'll give you a number. La Gazzetta today had only 4 pages about Sanremo. You did at least two of them. You did a huge spread in La Gazzetta. Yeah. But, you know, Sanremo is not quite what it used to be, is it? I was just saying to some colleagues here that this finish line used to be the craziest finish line in cycling. And, okay, they're approaching Cipressa, so 28 kilometres to go. Yeah. So there's a bit of time, but there aren't as many people as there used to be, are there?
I mean, it's a question of perspective, you know, of point of view. Obviously, if the comparison is with Flanders on Roubaix, it's obviously different. We have to consider that also in this period, Italian cycling has not really a rising star as, for example, Mathieu van der Poel or Tadej Pogacar or Wout van Aert or Remco Evenepoel. I think this can be considered the main reason. But in any case, the final of Sanremo is still fascinating, also without crowds on the road. But crowds, it's so important.
I think you're the closest thing that Italian cycling has got to rising star. Ciro, I'll let you go, but...
yes, because I have still to book my hotel for tonight.
Okay. Ciro, 2024, that was going to be a significant year. Was this not going to be the year of your retirement?
Dear listener, I'm still working on this. A crucial point, a turning point will be the end of the year. So after Tour of Lombardy, after Track Worlds in October in Denmark, I will think really about this. But I can assure you that this year I will still with you.
Ciro, the peloton is just approaching San Lorenzo al Mare and the Cipressa. We've got a stop. Watch is ready. We're going to have time this. We're hoping for the sub 9-minute Cipressa. Ciro, we'll see you at the Giro if we don't see you before that.
I hope so. I'm looking forward already to you, dear listeners, not really about this hectic final.
Brian, I am leaving Sanremo finally on Monday. It feels like...
Have you seen Groundhog Day?
It feels like a grand tour.
You're the Bill Murray of Sanremo.
I've loved it. I've loved it. I said to Ned Bolting earlier, it feels as though this should be a rite of passage now that everyone... Before you go to work on a race, a one-day race, you should have to spend a week there beforehand to really sort of soak up all of the culture and all of the...
Okay, let me just mention that...
Ambiance.
I don't know what kind of compensation I would ask for if you asked me to do that in either Liège or the town of Roubaix. But we're talking a lot of money then, right?
Yes. But, Brian, impressions of Sanremo. You've been here since yesterday.
For me, it was a lovely thing. I mean, it wasn't... Work-wise, it was... I think when you said you were going to be here, that basically made my decision. I wanted to come up and see Sanremo. And I've always... obviously done the start, maybe 16, 17 years in a row to go to Milano. And then just to see the other side of the race, just, you know, I would rush to the finish when I work for teams and try to be here to see as much of the race as possible. But today was just really tranquilo, and it felt like a real build up to the final, instead of just sitting like 4 hours in the car trying to race to beat the peloton to San Remo.
Yeah, we heard from Ciro just a minute ago, and I put it to Ciro that it's not quite as chaotic and it doesn't feel as raucous as it once did. So 20 years or so ago, my first San Remo was one that Mario Cipollini won. I remember him coming into the Ariston Theatre, which is just behind us, as discussed, and doing his press conference in there. And I can remember his press conference being pretty X-rated. There was lots of talk. There always was with Cipollini. Yeah. Lots of kind of analogies about orgasms and that sort of thing. It was kind of, you could say, the best of Cipollini or the worst. It's probably more like the worst of Cipollini. But it doesn't quite feel like the occasion it once was. The finish line isn't quite as chaotic as it once
and
was.
And not as... you and I spoke about that. It wasn't as densely populated, but it certainly was close to the podium and the finish line. There was heaps of people there. I think Viroma is a natural finish line for Milan Sanremo. But the years when they did it on the Lungomare Calvino, it had more of a beach type of vibe, even if it's just one block away from
beach
Viroma.
Type of vibe, perfect for Ciro. Absolutely, it's his classic, isn't it?
It is actually. At least it's certainly close enough to the sea for him.
Brian, another thing we've often said about Sanremo, when we've tried to describe this place to maybe English listeners or English-speaking listeners who haven't been here have sort of said it's a kind of faded seaside town. I've sort of changed my opinion of that over the last week or so.
You're becoming soft, Daniel.
No, it's pretty lively. It's pretty vibrant. It has been pretty vibrant this week. I think, as we discussed last night, it would be nice to be here in Festival Week. I've been doing a bit of reading, Brian, about the history of tourism in San Remo. I didn't realise how important this town was in Italian tourism. It was the
town of the Italian Riviera.
Yeah, it was the Italian tourist town. Certainly, well, the sort of inception of mass tourism in Italy, it was kind of here. 1854, there was a noblewoman, a San Remo noblewoman, Adele Roverizio di Roccasterone. She wrote a piece under a nom de plume. She pretended to be someone else, and she wrote a piece in a French magazine, La Presse, singing San Remo's praises. And what do you know, a couple of years later, or within months of this piece being published in La Presse in France,
I can see you doing this for The Economist.
Well, yeah, people started flocking to San Remo, and the first, well, very popular villa people stayed in, well, who did it belong to? Well, it belonged to Adele Roverizio di Roccasterone.
Follow the money.
Yeah, and that was 1854. 1855, there was also a famous novel written by a gentleman called Giovanni Ruffini, who he settled in Edinburgh, but he was from these parts, and he wrote a novel called Dottor Antonio, and it was about a Ligurian, so from here, doctor, who fell in love with an English girl called Lucy, who was on holiday here in San Remo. Apparently, this contributed a lot to the tourist boom, which continued, Brian. And
well, if you want to see what it kind of looked like instead of just looking at old photos, you should watch The Talented Mr. Ripley, where a certain part of that film is shot and takes place. A rather dark chapter in that movie takes place in San Remo, but it was certainly San Remo in its heyday.
Interesting. You're a bit of a talented Mr. No, you're not a talented Mr. Ripley figure. Oh,
I'm certainly not a talented Mr. Ripley. I would love to look like either Matt Damon or Jude Law, but I think those days are gone forever.
Yeah. And Brian, back to the race for, briefly, before we sign off and you head off to your Michelin-starred restaurant and I head off to my humble trattoria.
Are you not cooking first off tonight?
No, I'm not. Brian, we talked about Matej Mohoric. We talked about, Bahrain Victorious. He was obviously their main card today. Tell you who had a good ride today. Fred Wright, the British national champion. He finished 30th, but Fred was in prime position. He was in good position on the Poggio, setting up Matej Mohoric. And I caught up with Fred, who gave me a pretty comprehensive analysis of his team's race and the race in general at the buses after the finish. Let's hear from Fred now, shall we?
You looked as though you had a good... You were in perfect position on the Poggio. Just tell me the story of your day.
I think that's the way San Remo goes sometimes. Like, I kind of knew after last year, I was managed to lead the boys into the Poggio, so I was like feeling confident to step it up and try and race the final and try and get over the thing. But yeah, you come a long way for the legs to say no sometimes. But that's just the bike race. And yeah, it was fast. Was that the, someone said that's already, is that the fastest one? I don't know. Not quite.
Not sure.
Well, it felt fast, but then it always does. I think that's, it felt like we were on the coast pretty quick. It's kind of, there wasn't that much time for talking today. I kind of said, I think you're going to have a chance to have a natter with a few people, but actually it was in one line, just everyone chugging along nicely. So
Say this, you're going to hate me for telling you this, but Pogacar said it was easy. It was one of the easiest races he's ever done.
But I don't know. That's him. He should have ridden harder up the Cipressa then.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. So what did you feel about that, and what did you think about that? Because we'd all heard about this 9-minute ascent. It was 9 minutes 26 in the end, and they sort of slowed up towards the top. But yeah, I don't know how organised they were.
We definitely could. I thought we were going to go faster. I was sort of in the group telling myself, okay, it's going to stay at this pace. And I was pleasantly surprised that it went a little bit easier. I was still on the limit, but yeah, I was quite happy with my feeling on Cipressa. I was thinking, oh, this is a good day. I was looking forward to the Poggio. But yeah, we just, maybe not the 9 minute was possible, but I think if Poggi had had one more guy pulling a bit longer, I think maybe we would done a bit faster, because man, it did everyone was kind of looking, no one really knew what to do at the very top. It was like, oh, do I go? Do I? Which was, for someone like me, was perfect. It was a chance to just take a little breather before the descent. So.
And then Fred, so in the on the road between Chipperas and Poggio, it seemed to sort of back off a little bit, but not for very long. And I guess that's where the UAE, was partly where the UAE plan maybe failed a bit. They didn't really keep the pressure on, or they couldn't.
Yeah, I guess they. It's hard, you know. It's hard on these 4-5% climbs. You can't, you know, the guy on the front has to invest so much that, you know, the UAE, they obviously invested a lot on the Chipressa and a lot coming in to be in position for the Chipressa, that then it's kind of understandable that you're not perhaps going to have a guy who's immediately going to whack it after the descent. But yeah, that's kind of what they needed, or what, you know, what another team maybe. But then it was up to UAE to do that. So it did mean that the group behind came back, which always makes it a little bit more sketchy coming into the Poggio, because there's obviously more bodies that can position their leaders into the bottom of the climb. But actually, fortunately for us, Nikias came back in that group, so he put us into a good position. But yeah, unfortunately, I didn't. Mate put in a great race by all accounts. You know, making that attack that I think, to be honest, I don't think anyone expected Philipsen to climb, go so well. And I think in a different situation with no Philipsen there, then maybe he stays away. I haven't really watched it, but I think by all accounts Van der Poel did a good job sort of keeping things together for Philipsen. So yeah, in a different scenario, who knows? But it would have been nice to be in that front group, but the legs said otherwise today. But
and just lastly, Fred, so we saw Matej, he didn't manage to get that attack in, but what was the sort of dream scenario that you talked about on the bus this morning?
Yeah, I guess just having more options in situations like that, whether it's obviously he kind of knew what cards he needed to play, but if you got another guy there who can then counter that or block, you know, if I was there just to disrupt things a little bit, then obviously it makes things easier. So a little bit of a shame to not be there, but I'm happy with, obviously managed to recover in time after Paris-Nice, because that was a big old week. So no, happy with the feeling, and some nice races in Belgium to come.
So Brian, there you go. That's perfect as a bit of a final word. Fred says that if Tadej Pogacar found it easy today, and it was one of the easiest races he's done, he should have ridden bloody harder, shouldn't he?
And, yeah, right said Fred.
Yeah, right said Fred. Tadej's not too sexy for, I don't know, the Ligurian Riviera. Not yet, anyway. I think he will win it, but it wasn't this year.
He'll win anything he puts his mind to.
Yeah, and it's going to have to wait another 12 months. Brian, at this point, speaking of winning, I am going to bid you, buona serata, arrivederci. We'll be reunited for the Giro d'Italia in just over a month. It's looming large on the horizon, isn't it? And I very much look forward to that. We'll be back with another podcast, our usual weekly podcast. I think young Richard Abraham will be in the hot seat with Rob Hatch on Tuesday. That will probably be between Tuesday and Wednesday. We'll talk a bit more about Milan-San Remo. I'm sure there'll be a little bit, there'll be various inquests held over the next few hours, and we'll find out exactly what went right and what went wrong for all of the various protagonists. But Brian, I am going to wish you buona serata.
Well, buona serata. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.